Welcome back to another episode of Book Club Appetizer. I'm your book-obsessed host, Abby.
And I'm Emma. Abby and I are bringing you our snackable podcast that's perfect for kicking off book club meetings or enhancing your reading experience.
Yep, we're all about making book club easy. We pick titles that are sure to foster discussion and debate amongst your most literary friends, or even your not most literary friends.
All your dumb friends.
And then we bring the author into the studio for an exclusive interview.
And since after we pick the book, our minds immediately go to what we want to eat and drink while we talk about the plot, we pair each book with an appropriate appetizer and cocktail recipe served up by our friends at Taste.
Yeah, I'd say we spend just as much time thinking about the food as we do reading the book.
Which I think is fair. That is the recipe for a great book club.
Exactly. So the book we read this month is set in Britain during World War II. So we started thinking about serving a proper English tea while we discussed the novel.
I love British pastries, so I was very excited for this one. We're serving delicious berry scones, chock full of warm blueberries and raspberries. Oh, and also, they're vegan, they're gluten-free, and they still taste good.
Mm, they sound delicious. And as a nod to the British locale, we're obviously serving up Pym's Cups, the traditional English cocktail, which was first created by James Pym in 1820 for his London Oyster Bar. Our version is garnished with cucumber and mint, which makes for a heavenly aroma when you take a sip.
Plus, bonus snack.
Yeah, totally.
So before we introduce this month's read, recap the plot, and invite the author into the studio, we have to warn you, this podcast contains plot spoilers.
This month, we read The Chilbury Ladies' Choir by Jennifer Ryan, which is a sweeping work of historical fiction, and her debut novel, set, as we said, during World War II in the small English village of Chilbury. All of the men of the village are away at the front lines, and so as a result, the vicar posts a notice on the town board that says the village choir is to close.
Now, the women of Chilbury are not on board with this plan at all.
They're really not.
They are definitely going to keep singing. And the fact that it might seem strange at first during this time for them to keep their choir open, even though most of the men have gone away to war, is an allegory for women's other expanded roles on the home front during wartime. Suddenly, for the first time ever, they're allowed into many new industries and even just social roles that they weren't before. Some of them are working in factories, others are working as nurses, and it's really a broader step toward the women's liberation movement.
Oh, Emma, I like that. So this story really has something for everyone. There's the historical setting, of course. Then there's a bit of mystery and intrigue, a bit of romance between a few of the characters. And, okay, this cast of characters is truly memorable. I love them all. So the story centers on five different women, which are all members of the village choir. So let's recap them quickly, shall we?
We shall.
Okay, there's Mrs. Tilling, who is the timid widow who's just sent her son David off to the front lines and fears for his safety.
There are also the Winthrop girls. The elder is Venetia. She is the village beauty, and she's fallen in love with a mysterious newcomer to town. He's an artist, but he also seems to have a few secrets up his sleeves. Her younger sister, Kitty, is the typical precocious younger sister.
Yeah.
She wants to be a famous singer when she grows up. She's pining after an unrequited crush, and she's keeping tabs on all of the goings-on in the village.
And then staying with the Winthrop family is Sylvie, a Jewish refugee from Czechoslovakia who is alone and constantly wondering about the fate of the rest of her family left back in Czechoslovakia under Nazi occupation. And then finally, there's Miss Edwina Paltry, a conniving midwife who is trying to outrun her shady past while still trying to pull the wool over all of the eyes of the villagers around her.
Definitely a schemer, that one.
Yeah. Who was your favorite?
Now, I waffle every time someone asks me this question, but right now I think my favorite is Mrs. Tilling.
Oh, I love Mrs. Tilling. I also have two favorites. I loved Kitty, but I also loved Miss Paltry because she was really the comedic relief in some parts.
Absolutely. She has that sharper edge, too.
Totally.
And one of the things that I think really sets her apart is, because this is an epistolary novel, which you know I love, we see the story through the journals and the letters of our five main characters. And Miss Paltry is the person whose public persona varies the most from her inner thoughts as expressed to a trusted family member. I love the device of an epistolary novel because, again, you get that kind of delineation between how people see themselves, how they want to be seen, and what their true inner monologues and feelings are.
Yeah, another thing I really liked were the gorgeous endpapers in the hardcover version of this book. It serves as a map of Chilbury Village, so as the characters wander around from place to place, I could flip back to the front and follow along on their journey. And for all of you who maybe read this in the ebook version, we have an awesome annotated map that is on our podcast page. So that's readitforward.com/podcast. And so you can click and follow along and learn all about the setting of this novel.
And explore the whole village.
Another thing I loved is just the musical quality of this book. I mean, it's even the writing takes on this sort of lilting musical quality that really pleases the ear.
And I love that the specific songs are referenced in a way that you can look them up. They're real songs, they're contemporary to the time, and it really helps set the scene to know exactly what songs the choir is working on. No spoilers, but toward the end when they start working on some contemporary numbers, things that they would have heard on the radio that were popular at the time. I love that kind of thing. I think it really paints the fullest picture when you're imagining that you might actually be there with them as well.
Totally. And another thing I love about this novel is it's very appealing across all generations. So my mom, my grandmother, and I all read this book, and we all loved it for different reasons. So I had my mom texting me about it, my grandmother emailing me as they got to different parts, and they just wanted to talk about it. So this book really makes you want to discuss.
I love it. You have your own mini book club right there.
I do.
Well, we could talk about this novel, A Female Strength and Indomitable Spirits, basically forever, but there are some questions that only the author can answer. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with the Chilbury Ladies Choir author Jennifer Ryan in the studio after this brief message. This episode of Book Club Appetizer is brought to you by Taste, an online magazine for people who love to cook at home. The newly relaunched site offers approachable recipes, essays on popular and emerging ingredients, and stories reported from the front lines of today's quickly moving food culture. Check them out at tastecooking.com.
And now we welcome Jennifer Ryan, author of The Chilbury Ladies Choir, into the studio. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here on Book Club Appetizer.
Thank you for having me.
I have to say I love your novel, The Chilbury Ladies Choir. Where did you get this idea? How did this come to you?
So, my grandmother, when I was growing up, we had this amazing grandmother called, that we called Party Granny. We also had another grandmother who we called Shakespeare Granny, but she only did tragedies with us. And her favorite tragedy was Measure for Measure, which isn't even a particularly interesting tragedy, but she loved doing these very serious tomes with us. But Party Granny was like the polar opposite. She couldn't think of anything better than putting on a pair of high-heeled shoes and a bit of makeup and a nice frock and making lots of food for parties and rolling up the rug on the floor so that people could dance. And she just loved a good party. So she used to tell these hysterical stories about the war and how her and her friend Letty used to, and both of them belonged to a choir, so there were a lot of stories about the choir. And she just really brought that era to life, and, you know, how the church on Sundays was rife with gossip and women were mending tires and cleaning windows and driving buses and wearing trousers and everything. And she had all these funny stories about the choir and Letty and the change in sexual attitudes during the time, because of course you might die, or your loved ones might die, or you might get invaded. So what's the point in, you know, saving yourself for marriage or anything? So there were a lot of affairs as well. And these she knew how to tell these stories. Absolutely, you know, the secret passions, the meetings, the clandestine, you know, togetherness, and then, you know, the being found out, oh no, everything. It was just great. Anyway, so I, with that background, I think I always had a yearning to write something in that ilk, basically, with that feeling behind it. And but then I became very interested in reading about the Second World War about 10 years ago, when I was visiting my mother and I was looking at her bookshelf, and there was this brilliant book there that I picked up by Penelope Lively, and it's called A House Unlocked. And it's a biography of a house that has been in her family for many generations. And she basically went through history, kind of picking out the parts where what happened in the house was very interesting, both from a sociological point of view and historical point of view, but, you know, sometimes from a personal point of view, according to her family. But there was a chapter about the Second World War when her aunt, who was very young at the time, a young woman, was involved in housing evacuees that came over from Europe. And she would find homes for them and families to look after them for the duration of the war. And so obviously her mother, who was at this house in the countryside, ended up taking about 20 of them. So, but she, throughout this chapter, she talked a lot about the evacuees and the era. And at the end of the chapter, I just wanted to know more. So I went to the local bookstore and I found some other memoirs about the war. There's actually quite a few British people who were evacuated during the war who wrote memoirs about them. And they're absolutely fascinating. They really are. And then there's also quite a few diaries and journals as well from that era. And so I just started reading, you know, instead of reading novels and everything, I just started reading. I became very fascinated with this particular era and reading these first-hand accounts. So following that, I think about 5 years ago, I was editing a book about the war in Afghanistan and thinking about writing my own book. The book about the war in Afghanistan, it was following this man who was killed in battle and his wife, how she got that knock at the door. And I remember thinking, she has no control over this process. She is at home in the UK while her husband is out there fighting the war. She's got these two small children. She has no say in what is going on at all. And there she is. It must be devastating for her. And I found myself really considering this entire situation that war really throws everything up in the air. And I think I just wanted to investigate it more. And one of the journals that I had read from the Second World War was by a woman called Nella Last, and she wrote an awful lot about her son going to war and what might happen to him and what she might have to face, and about the other women in the community who had lost sons, who had lost husbands. And then, of course, they started losing civilian friends when the bombing happened as well, and the Blitz. And I think I just wanted to investigate that further. And it all came together at a time when I started thinking about writing a novel. And it seemed everything came together. My grandmother's stories, all this research I'd done about the Second World War, and this fascination I had for that era. And then suddenly this real moment of, I just wanted to really investigate what it was like to be left behind.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So all of those threads come together in these five central women who are the central characters of the book. There's Mrs. Tilling, who does send her son off to war. There's Kitty, who's the aspiring singer who gets really imbued by the music. There's Mrs. Paltry, there's Sylvie, who's one of the evacuees. So how did all of these threads come together in these five women?
So Mrs. Tilling, in a way, is a character who is a little bit like Nella Last in the fact that her son goes to war. But Nella Last's story is a very interesting one because she begins the war and she's just getting through a breakdown and she has to lie down every afternoon and she has to cook her husband's lunch at lunchtime and she's always taking aspirin for headaches. But through the war, she gets very involved in the women's voluntary service and she is running canteens and doing sewing and involved in this group and involved in that group and going around to people's houses, the bereaved, helping out, making sure that everyone's being looked after. And by the end of the war, she stops taking the naps in the afternoon. She stops taking aspirin. And by the end of the war, she's not making lunch for her husband either. And he is not happy about it. And but in a way, what I loved about that story, and I suppose what I was trying to do with Chilbury, was to show how women during the war, they had to rethink things. They had to rethink their roles. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was never really defined for them. This was their moment when they were given this sudden freedom and they could take it however far they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Tilling goes from this very timid widow figure to someone who really finds her voice. And by the end of the book, she is rethinking the societal values around her, mm-hmm. and taking on responsibility for her own life and her own thoughts and taking chances. I think there's a really big part in this is that she is taking chances. She's not playing it safe anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to open your novel, there's an image of a notice that's pinned to the community board that reads, as all of our male voices have gone off to war, the village choir is to close. And so there's a major metaphor afoot here that women's voices aren't considered worthy of hearing or listening to, either in song or otherwise. So the recurring theme in this novel, as you just said, is the growing strength of these women's voices. in song in the ladies' choir and then in their communities as a whole. So why is it important for today's readers to sort of understand the huge leap that women were able to make when the men were off at war?
Well, I think, I mean, really what I want the readers to take away from this is that it doesn't matter really where you are in your life or in which era you're in. You can always look around at the structures around you and the societal mores which you're surrounded by and challenge them and decide for yourself whether this is something that is imposed upon you or whether you actually agree with what it is. And that's really particularly what Mrs. Tilling is doing throughout, is she starts really wondering about some of the things around her that she's always believed to be true and the men have always told her are true and the papers have told her and everyone has, even her mother has told her. And she gets to the point where she starts to rethink, you know, first one thing and then another thing. And she realizes that it's not as black and white as she seems, as it all seems. And there's a dense mesh, I think she says at one point, there's a dense mesh between reality and morality. And I think she's trying to unravel that the whole time. I don't think she gets to an end of that. I think the end result is that she realizes that there is that dense mesh and it's not that black and white. And I think readers can take away from that a certain feeling that they are free to do the same thing, that everyone's free to question these suppositions that are around them, the way that they are brought up, the way, and this is men and women, it's all of us. You know, sometimes it's quite difficult to step out, step back from where we are and actually challenge our belief systems and challenge what it is that we've been taught as children. And that's, I don't think you're ever in a place in your life where you can stop doing that.
You tell this story using journal entries and letters and diaries. Why did you choose to do an epistolary novel? What can these letters and diary entries show us or teach us that maybe just an ordinary narrator can't?
So I chose this. The main reason is because of reading these diaries. They're such good reads because you really get into the mindset of, first of all, you know, the era, the person that's writing it, and you see right into their heart through these diary entries. I think journals, particularly more than letters, really allow you to go really dig deep into what someone's really thinking and feeling. Secondly, I love the use of the speech at the time. I think it's a very evocative way to really take the reader into the era. I think the patterns of speech are, you know, they're not that different from today, but they are different enough that it can transform you. But as soon as you start reading, you're back in that era. And I really wanted to, having enjoyed that myself, having read the journals, I wanted to help my readers do the same thing. So that was the main reason. The other thing is that I love the, you know, epistolary novels myself. I think they make for a very good read.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about, this was an effort that was started by the British government during wartime to get these firsthand documents from women. This was a real initiative.
Yeah, it was. So just before the war started, there were a couple of sociologists in London who were connected. I think loosely connected to the government, mm-hmm. but they had this idea that it would be good to get everyone in the country to write journals and then to collect all these journals and use them to basically gauge how the home front was dealing with the war situation, with the rationing, because they knew that rationing was going to come and everything. And basically, they wanted to also use it because there were certain things that the government was set to do during the war that would impact the populace in particular ways. And I think they really wanted to measure to see how effective it was and everything. There was a big feeling at the time that the morale on the home front was incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And without good morale on the home front, then the war was going to be lost. And it was all part of that effort. We want to keep people happy and let's see how they're doing through this one way. So they put out this advertisements in all the press saying, you know, join us, you know, write a journal, send in your journal entries. And they bought a newsletter out every month where they would print some of the parts of the journals. So there was a good incentive for people, particularly people like Nella Last, who always enjoyed writing and kind of had a secret yearning to be a writer as well. And she writes incredibly well. She really does. And so at the beginning, I think 700 people joined up. But by the end, I think there were, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people writing for the it was called Mass Observation. Hmm. So MO, and it was, I mean, from a researcher's point of view, it is amazing. It has so much information. Mm. And it wasn't just women, it was men and children. Anyone who was at home on the home front could join in and do it.
Wow. And what a lasting legacy to have sort of real-time updates told by real, ordinary people. Not filtered through the history books.
Yeah. So you can actually go and see them. They're in a university, stored in a university in England.
And did you go?
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's incredible to actually see, like, all handwritten, you know, documents.
Wow. In bound notebooks or loose paper?
Most of them are just loose paper mm-hmm. because they had to hand them in.
Right.
But yeah, that it's incredible.
That is very cool. So one of my favorite characters in this book is the character of the music teacher, Prim, and she espouses to these women in the choir that the most important part of singing is feeling. And I know you studied music. How can music heal those whose lives are otherwise ravaged by war? I mean, this choir goes to sing to the town of Litchfield, who's been bombed. There is a very significant sense that music is one of the only things in this wartime that can uplift. What's your relationship to music? Is that something you've always felt?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, music can affect you in, I think, very different ways, you know, but it does. I mean, the impact on the emotions is amazing. I edited an amazing book before I wrote Chilbury, which was called Human Music, and it was written by a cellist called David Tai, and it's basically all about how music affects your emotions, but in different ways. Every part of music plays a different role. You know, the different cadences can be used in different ways to kind of promote sadness or happiness or a kind of feeling of, and you know, the arcs in certain songs. I mean, for example, Kitty at the end sings Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which just in so many ways describes, you know, that sweeping arc of the music, of how she wishes she was somewhere else, but at the same time she's trying to come to terms with her own situation. And that's how I've tried to use the music throughout, is to kind of describe what it is that the people in the book are actually going through at that time, what they're trying to come to terms with, what it is that they're going through. But in a way, them making the music together is probably the most important part, is that they are standing together and supporting one another and singing together. And that bonding part of it is just very central to the feeling of the book.
And in wartime, when everything's rationed, singing is free.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Excellent, Jennifer. Well, thank you so much for being here, and it was
great to chat.
Thanks for listening, readers. We have some reader questions on our site, in addition to a link to the awesome Spotify playlist we put together to accompany Jennifer's book. And this book, as we said, is so musical. And of course, we were totally inspired.
And if you liked the Chilbury Ladies Choir and want to read more books like it, well, the Read It Forward team has got your back. We've suggested a few recommendations on readitforward.com/podcast. And we're over here producing monthly podcasts centered on fantastic books we think you should read either with your book club or alone. So when you need something new to read, come see what we've been devouring.
And whether you've listened to every single one of our episodes or you're a first-time listener, we'd love to know what you think of our show. Take a minute and leave us a review on iTunes. We'd super appreciate it.
And as always, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @ReadItForward, and tweet about books with us. Happy reading, and cheers!